वाचां मलं शरीरस्य च वैद्येन योपाकरोत्तं प्रवरं मुनीनां पतञ्जलिं प्राञ्जलिरानतोऽस्मि स्तुवे पतञ्जलिं व्यासं शङ्करं च मुनित्रयं कर्तृसूत्रस्य भाष्यस्य क्रमाद्विवरणस्य च So in the last class we were discussing the 21st sutra of the second chapter sadhana pada tadartham eva drishyasi atma we already discussed this earlier now we'll come to the 22nd sutra and 23rd the 22nd one is kridartham prati nashtamabhi anashtam tadanya sadharanatvat see 22nd sutra Now, what happens when we reach the highest liberation? Such a state is called Kridartha, means the person who has reached his goal in life. So we have to come back to the subject again. We are discussing the problem of imperfection. The cause for association, the cause for bondage was already explained earlier. Drashtru drishyoku drishyoku samyogo heya hetuhu. There is a description. That is, the cause of suffering is the association of the seer and the seeing. That is 17th sutra of the second chapter. So, when we interact with the external world, with our mind and the five senses of perception, we identify ourselves with these objective phenomena, objective experiences. When I see an object, and when I perceive it with my mind, an image arises in my mind, and as a result, I identify myself with that object. That's why we often feel affected by what we see around. We had to be affected, true, because interaction and dealing with different experiences, different persons, different events in the world requires some kind of identification. But that identification leads to a kind of bondage. So that's why we get excited, we get angry, we get anxious, worried, we become overjoyed as a part of our interaction with the external experiences. And when these things happen, we become victims of these objective experiences. So this is called samyoga, in fact, in this particular context. I mean association between the seer, the purusha, the subject, and the seen object, the experienced things. This identification leads to our forgetfulness as to what we are. In the coming sutra, we will describe this further. How we fail to transcend the body consciousness, the empirical consciousness, when we forget our true nature, and when we identify ourselves with the external things. That we'll describe in the coming sutra. So, this sutra says, when a spiritually enlightened person reaches a very high level of spiritual evolution, he is no more affected by external things. He may live in this world, he may carry on his duties and responsibilities. He also will have problems, anxieties. But the difference is he won't be swayed. He won't be overpowered. He won't be overwhelmed. He won't lose his balance while interacting these unfortunate or maybe unhappy events. That's the only difference. So, in a way, yoga or Vedanta doesn't remove problems. They help us to confront these problems from a different perspective, because problems cannot be solved. You find if you read any of these scriptures, major scriptures, why should God create problems in this world if God is very compassionate, merciful? The question arises. The agnostics and the atheists ask this question. God is very is a wonderful being, then why should there be all these problems? So that question itself is, in a way, meaningless. Unless you accept the theory that God sat down one day and created this world. But that's not the view of Vedanta and yoga. Yoga tries to look around, analyze the life that goes around us, and it analyzes our own problems, and then tries to find a logical explanation to the realities of everyday experience. So it says, yoga enables us to confront the problems, the reality of the external world, the prakriti, and at the same time, it enables us to go beyond it. So in the coming sutras, you will come across one interesting theory in the next sutra. The word samyoga in yoga literally means association. So as I mentioned earlier, when we live in this world, when we come across, interact with different problems and confront different problems, frequently we lose our balance, we become anxious, we lose our patience, peace of mind, all these things happen. Now, so this is due to association. In that case, is this association, samyoga, a wholly evil thing? It is something totally evil? There you come across another theory. Samyoga is not something evil. This world itself is not evil. The world enables us to grow spiritually. That is an interesting theory in yoga. In fact, Swami Vivekananda, in one of his lectures, take this idea, of course, this is from Vedanta, which came to yoga in later centuries. Vivekananda makes a very interesting statement. This world is a gymnasium for us to work out our karmas. This is a simple sentence, it says. The world is a gymnasium. Gymnasium is a place where we go to for exercises. It may be like a school, for example, kindergarten, where we go to learn the alphabet's fundamental lessons. It's not a place where we live, where we reside. It's not a place where which we belong to us. We don't belong to that place. But it is a place that we go to at one stage of our education to educate ourselves. But then our purpose is to go beyond that particular stage of education. Every child who goes to primary school dreams of going to the university at some time in future. Similarly, this samyoga, this association, these problems, all these everyday realities that we cannot run away from, that we have to confront with a new wisdom, with a new perspective that we get from yoga, it enables us to grow spiritually. So the world is a very wonderful instrument for us to grow spiritually. It is not something to be run away from. It is not something to be avoided. It is something that we have to deal with in an intelligent way from a higher spiritual perspective. So that's a subject we are going to deal with in the 23rd sutra. You find Suswami Shaktiyoho Surupalabdhihituhu Samyoga. It means this association, this identification with these emerging objective experiences, which was described as a cause of suffering in the 17th sutra earlier, is now described as not only the cause of sufferings or imperfection, but also the cause of liberation. How is it so? If the world did not exist, we won't become spiritually illumined. Our spiritual liberation depends upon this world. Otherwise, what will we do? Suppose the world is full of, suppose everything is all right in this world. way everyone has got enough peace of mind, enough money, enough wealth, everything. Then there will be no literature, no philosophy, no music, no mysticism, no religion, nothing very happy about it. Suppose you never feel hungry, then the whole art of cooking will vanish. Whatever the wonderful food, drinks that you buy from markets and enjoy, those things have no value if suddenly one day God takes away hunger and thirst. It doesn't happen. Suppose everything is all right in this world. You never worry about anything. Suppose we get enough food, enough clothing, no problems. People won't go to churches or temples or Vedanta societies, won't read scriptures, won't go to music, Beethoven or Mozart or Tyagaraja or Swadhi Thirunal, all the great musicians of the world, they'll have no job to do. No mysticism, no religion, no philosophy, no music, no art, no painting, nothing. Life will still will lose its music. So, it's a very interesting analysis of the everyday existence of human beings. So this world of imperfections, of limitations, of so-called problems, has a meaning, has a purpose. The purpose is to take us beyond itself. It helps us to transcend itself. That's a very interesting perspective. But there is a difference. When we look at the world and our own life from this perspective, then the world itself becomes a great help, a great means, a great instrument for our spiritual growth. That's the meaning of Vivekananda's statement. He makes the statement, actually he takes an idea from the Upanishads. What he says is, the world is a gymnasium for us to work out our karmas. If you work out every day, if you go to gymnasium, you can avoid many of the physical problems, many sickness, many illness, all these things you can avoid. Similarly, if we look upon this world as a means, as a stage beyond which we have to go, you have to transcend, then the world itself becomes an instrument. That's the meaning, that's the idea explained in the 23rd sutra, that we will come to that. So this particular sutra has got this meaning. The meaning is this: for a liberated person, sikkhardartha, sikkhardartham prati. I mean, to a jiva who has realized his true identity, that he is Purusha, he is not Prakriti, he is not a being that is affected by every day, every moment experiences of this world, but a transcendental, ever blissful, supreme being, intelligent being. When that truth is realized, this world exists, but then it exists in a different way. The difference between a spiritually illumined person, a spiritually elevated person, and an ordinary person who is not spiritually elevated is this. The spiritually elevated person is no more affected adversely by these things. All the problems continue, but you'll be able to look upon the problems from a different perspective. The whole perspective changes because he understands it is the nature of the world. Then it no more affects him. So that's the meaning of the 22nd sutra. For that particular liberated person, these limitations, these obsessions, these attachments, this bondage, all gone. But it continues to exist for all others. That's the meaning. Now we'll come to 23rd sutra, which is very important in this. It is, so swami shaktyoho surupalabdhihetuhu samyogaha. So here is a different definition of samyoga. Samyoga means association of the seer with the seen. In actual practical life, what association means is this. We are in our true nature, one eternal, blissful, transcendental being. But then, when we interact with the external world, everyday experiences, painful and maybe sometimes not so painful experiences, happy and unhappy experiences, our mind is affected. Our mind becomes happy or unhappy, anxious, sad or sorrowful. Very often, people read newspapers, people watching different events in this world, they are terribly affected. Mental life, intellectual life, inner life is affected. Yoga doesn't tell you to remain unaffected. Yoga doesn't ask us to become totally insensitive beings with all emotions completely gone. I mean, totally insensitive. In for all the great practitioners of this higher yoga or Vedanta, were the most humane, most compassionate beings. The difference is they are no more enslaved. Spiritually, they are no more bound or enslaved by these everyday experiences. So, this sutra, those who have the mantra text before you, because need some explanation. So swami shaktyoho, he means this. Swa here means, it means the external world, prakriti. The seen, the experienced. So what is the shakti of prakriti? So shakti means, here swa means drishyam, prakriti. Prakriti by its very nature is jata, it is unconscious. So swami shaktiyoko. Swami here means purusha. Shakti here means chetanatvena drishtatva yogyata. So purusha is drashta, the seer, the experiencer, the perceiver, the witness, the subject. And prakriti is the drishyam, the seeing, the objective phenomena. Now, what happens is the association between them becomes the cause for knowing the true nature. Surupo balabdhi hetuhu samyoga. So samyoga here means not only the momentary identification of the seer with the external things, but also the re-education through which the seer understands his true nature, that seer is different from the seen. This sutra is a bit complicated, but you are most free to ask questions after the class. Or those of you who may not get time, you can even write emails to us. This is very in our address. So it's a very important sutra from... So I shall have to go through it in a very systematic way. So what is the meaning of samyoga in the sense that it takes you beyond the world? How does this association with the purusha and prakriti, the subject and object, the seer and the seen, becomes a cause for true knowledge and gradually liberation? Because true knowledge necessarily leads you to proper understanding, and that understanding is called vidya, and that vidya destroys avidya or ignorance, which is the cause of bondage. And by destroying the avidya or ignorance, it becomes the cause of liberation through vidya. This is the idea behind. Now, coming to the subject. First of all, when we understand the nature of the world through association, through some yoga, through identification, we understand the limitations of the world. The world can be a wonderful education for us. It can be a wonderful teacher It can be a wonderful tormentor also. This world can be a wonderful teacher. From one perspective, the world itself becomes an open book that educates us. From one perspective, this body and its limitations can convince us of the need to go beyond body consciousness. Look at the human body. Look at the whole world. The wonderful nature, the mountains, the valleys, the rivers, our own human body. From one point of view, it is something that we love, we want to preserve, we go out of the way to protect and preserve. But then from another perspective, we realize that in spite of our best efforts, this body won't last it for long. Means it is not eternal, it is not immortal. It has got a time limit. It has a beginning, so it will have an end. Similarly, this external world, the beautiful external world, all these things are useful, but at the same time, we can realize from a higher perspective that this world itself is not immortal. So, on the one hand, it helps us to develop powers of discrimination and understanding. On the other hand, it helps us to understand its limitations. In fact, the beginning of human wisdom, in a way human civilization, human culture, is that it begins with the realization of the limitation of the physical phenomena. That's the beginning of human civilization. If we could ever get fully satisfied with physical comforts, a wonderful home, wonderful food to eat, a long life, then human civilizations, the highest civilizations and cultures would not have emerged in the world. You look at the history of the human civilization. Which are the great cultures and civilizations that we remember? Those civilizations which thought beyond, thought of a transcendental reality that goes beyond the physical, beyond the today, beyond the visible, the empirical. The great teachers of the world, whom do we remember today? The great teachers who pointed out, pointed the finger towards something that lies beyond the physical, beyond the empirical, beyond the worldly, beyond the visible things. So, first of all, the beginning of human refinement, not only spiritual culture, is the realization of the limitation of the physical. The physical always corresponds to prakriti. Why? Prakriti, as I mentioned earlier, prakriti is drishyam. And what is its shakti, its special potency? It is jadatvam. Jadatvam means the state of unconsciousness, the absence of awareness. Life is jada means lifeless. It is not conscious. This body by itself, it may remain conscious maybe for 100 years for a healthy person. Then it goes away. So, the beginning of human civilization is with the realization of the limitation of the physical, the empirical, the worldly, the phenomenal things. And they correspond, all these things together correspond to the prakriti, the drishyam. What lies beyond the transcendental? It is purusha. Purusha, as I said earlier, in the Sankhya and Yoga systems, corresponds to consciousness. It is chetanatvam. So, chetanatvena drishtutva yogyata. That is the here Swami Shakti. So, two words are the Sushakti and Swami Shakti. Sushakti means the characteristics of prakriti. That is jadatvena drishyatvam. Means this prakriti, this empirical world, this physical universe is jada, unconscious, by its true nature. It is limited. It is nothing but a combination of different evolutes. Evolves from prakriti mahatvattum, ahankaram. Then our mind and our intellect, the five senses of perception, five senses of action, and the objective phenomena. That's all. Pancha Mahabhutas called. So together, total 23 evolutes, prakriti 24. This is prakriti. And its characteristic is that jatatvam, or it means absence of consciousness. The consciousness should come from elsewhere. The body by itself is not conscious. That's why, you know, a person, when he dies, the body is no more, not different from a piece of wood or a piece of stone. So in Sanskrit it's called Shiva becomes Shava. Shava means dead body. Shiva means a dead body in which the divine spark manifests. That is Shiva. And the divine spark, Purusha vanishes, the Atman vanishes, then it becomes Shava, means dead body. So, Sushakti here means the unconscious nature of Prakriti, Adrishya. Swami Shakti means the consciousness, the effulgence, that's the true nature of Purusha. Now what happens, you know, this association. This association creates this world, but through proper perspective, it also helps us to go beyond this world. So there is an interesting description by Vyasa in his commentary. So Vyasa says, Drishyasya upalabdhihi yasa bhoga yatu drashtuku sarupalabdhihi sa apavarga. So Vyasa gives an interesting description. Drishyasya upalabdhihi. So in the case of Drishya, the external world, the realization of the true nature and the characteristics of this physical universe means enjoyment, bhoga. That's when we, with the use of science and technology, you can manipulate the external world, you can create new powers, and you can create more comforts, life becomes more comfortable, more happy. Worldly enjoyments, worldly pleasures. This is bhoga. By making proper use of this external phenomena, this physical universe, with the help of science and technology, human intelligence. This is human enjoyment. This is what happens in the case of Drishya or Prakriti. In the case of Drashta, the Purusha, the realization of the conscious nature of Purusha leads to Apavarga, means liberation. That's the meaning of the statement by Vyasa, who makes a very great statement. It's a famous statement in the Vyasa's commentary, which throws light to the true meaning of the sutra. So Vyasa says, Drishyasya upalabdhihi yasa bhogaha yatu drashtuku sarupalabdhihi sa apavargaha. So, with regard to drishya, the realization of the true nature of this external universe, the manipulation of its various powers and gifts helps us to enjoy bhoga. On the other hand, when we realize the true nature of what we really are, apart from the physical, the worldly, when we realize the true nature of inner divine spirit, it leads to liberation. So this cannot happen without some yoga. Because when you interact with the external world, then only we sometimes are forced to admit, well, this external world has its limitations. For some time, when everything goes fine, we feel, oh, it's wonderful. Then suddenly, when we get blows from external world, then that day we may go and read the Bible, may go to church or a temple, may start speaking on philosophy. Sometimes, you know, the world itself may give us catches by the throat and make philosophers of us. That's a statement by Kant. practical reason. The world can catch you by the throat and make philosophers of us. The world gives blows. Go on living in the world through bhoga. That's why, you know, Vyasa says, trisyasya upalabdhi yasa bhogaha. So, the realization of the true nature, the understanding of the full faculties and gifts and powers of external world, the five elements and their faculties, which we develop through science and technology, that leads to bhoga. But in the process, like, you know, it sometimes is said in science fiction stories, there are hypothetical theories. One day suddenly all the computers and machines take over the world and wage a war on humanity. So the robots catch the throat of its operator. So the machines and laboratory equipments and computers start waging war on humanity, something like that. At one stage, this prakriti, this external world which we enjoy, suddenly reveal its own limitations. And then what happens? Yatu drashtuku swarupa leptihi. Then we really understand the true nature of our own reality. Because we are forced to look beyond empirical, we are forced to look towards the transcendental. And that takes us to liberation in the spiritual sense. Before liberation, it may help us to become philosophers, artists, musicians, and thinkers. And finally, it may take us to a higher level of evolution when we become fed up with the external things and look for a transcendental spiritual meaning for our life and existence. So that is one great interpretation by Vyasa. It's a very famous interpretation by Vyasa. The realization of the true nature of external world beyond the limits, when it reaches the highest limit, takes us beyond itself, beyond the empirical world itself. That's an idea. That's why. So the external world is not evil. That's why, and that's the meaning of the relevance of Vivekananda's statement, the world is a gymnasium, school, where we go to study, or we do exercise, because it helps us to get physical health and strength. That's why the prakriti or drishyam, its activity, helps us to the attainment of liberation. Now, what is really evil is not prakriti, but avidya or ignorance. And this ignorance is the real cause of the problems. Okay, there are different views. Another commentator, Bhoja, he has a different interpretation for the word surupalepti. He says, sacha sahaja bhoga bhoktur subhava rupatva na anyaha. Of course, he gives interpretation which is somewhat limited. You know, what he says is knowledge of the natural state of existence as the enjoyed and the enjoyer is a limited in scope in understanding this particular statement. Now, coming to Vedanta, you get some new light on this particular ideal. That's why yoga becomes complete when it merges with Vedanta. In Vedanta, there's a great view in this man, in this context. So the statement in the Mandukya Karika, which is a commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad. Mandukya Karika is a commentary in metrical verses on the Mandukya Upanishad, which has only 12 mantras, 12 verses. The Karika itself has got 215 verses. So it is written by the great Advaitin, his name was Gaudapada, who lived about 150 years before Shankaracharya. The whole text became illumined. Its meaning became very clear through the commentary of Shankaracharya. So there is a statement in that book. Anadi maya supto yadha jiva prabuddhide ajamanidra masuptam advedam vidyade tatha. This means anadi maya suptaha yadha jiva prabuddhide. The meaning is this. Jiva means living beings, all of us. We are in a state of total we are totally unconsciousness. We are in a state of unawareness, non-awareness of our true reality. So it's called nidra. It is sleep, an eternal sleep. We are in a state of spiritual inertia. We are asleep, spiritually speaking. So one day when we wake up and open our eyes, we realize what we are. This is a very symbolic statement. And that moment we realize that we are the Purusha in the context of yoga. So we have been thinking for a long time that we are the physical body. And so long as we think we are only the physical bodies, the smallest, slightest physical problems will crush us mentally and physically. Because we are very often what we interpret ourselves as what we are. Very often, our condition, our psychological condition depends upon what we perceive ourselves to be. There's a great psychological truth in it. It's a person who thinks he's just a physical being. The slightest physical problem, a momentary problem, a problem that may not last more than a day, will have a crushing effect on him or her. But there are people who are more educated, intellectually more illumined, more refined, could spend time in poetry and music and philosophy. For them, even if they don't eat one day, if they're hungry, it doesn't matter. They can take refuge in a good book or singing a song or in music. I'm just giving an example from everyday life. So there is a, what we call, an ascending order of human consciousness, beginning with the lowest physical level, going through different phases, different stages, the mental, intellectual, emotional, and so on. So when we transcend the physical level, when we reach the mental, intellectual, emotional level, we are able to enjoy a great book, a great idea, a great music, and forget for the moment the ordinary physical problems. Then physical problems are no more so terrible. They don't have a crushing effect on our mind. But Vedanta and yoga says if you still go beyond the intellectual, the emotional, and the mental, to the spiritual level, then even problems at the intellectual level will not affect us. So there is an ascending order in the evolution of human consciousness. So Vedanta says when you get the true knowledge, true realization, as to what we are, that moment liberation, spiritual liberation, becomes a reality for us. What's the meaning of spiritual liberation in real terms? It's not going to heaven. Heaven doesn't have any meaning in Advaitic tradition. Heaven is no more not a lesser bondage than this world. Heaven is also a bondage from Advaitic point of view, because in monotheistic tradition, in popular Hindu tradition, heaven is a place where you enjoy whatever you can enjoy in a 5-star hotel. That's all. Nothing more. So heaven is a very limited concept in Vedanta. So the point is, when you realize this true nature, that's why Yatha jiva prabuddhite. When spiritually, when we wake up, when we become awakened to the reality that we are the Atman, that moment we are liberated. That very moment we are liberated. It doesn't mean that we go to heaven, as I said. It means we continue living in this world with a new perspective, with a new outlook. The difference is, the world will no more have a crushing effect on our mind or our psyche. It will continue living, existing, but we won't be affected by that. That's the idea you find in the yoga tradition also, even after liberation, Prakriti and Purusha exist side by side. But there will be no samyoga, because there will be no avidya, no ignorance. That's the meaning of liberation in yoga. Now, what is the real cause of this samyoga? The real cause of samyoga in yoga system is tasya hetuhu avidya. The cause of this samyoga is avidya. The samyoga that creates bondage, the samyoga or the association of the seer with the seen, the Purusha and Prakriti, that makes us blind to the fact that we are in true nature, the Atman itself, that ignorance vanishes. Because this ignorance keeps us bound to the physical level. And as I said, not only spirituality, but the human civilization and culture also begin the moment we transcend the physical level. So now we will have interaction for about 10-15 minutes. So you can, because we had no class last week, so if there are any questions, any subjects to be discussed, we can raise questions. Any topic is open to us. Those who, there may be some of you who were coming for the first time for this class, so some of you may be new, so you can ask any questions.
If the purpose is to realize our true nature, why were we separated from our true nature in the first place?
Yeah. In fact, I answered this question on several previous occasions, so coming to that. You know, this question is relevant only from one perspective. If you believe in creationist theories, that's why. That's very important. The question is very significant from a creationistic point of view. But in yoga, you know what the yoga is doing? Yoga is not worried about the creator or anything. Yoga is trying to analyze the world that we experience and is trying to analyze our own mental world, the world of our emotions, our thinking, our own life. So it is trying to give a scientific analysis of the reality of human existence by taking us from effect to cause. It doesn't begin with a cause. In creationism, you begin with a cause. But in yoga believes, in a way, interestingly, yoga believes in its own version of evolutionary theory. Not biological evolution at the physical level. Yoga doesn't discuss that subject, but discusses evolution at the psychological and mental level. So it asks you to look around and see the world in which you are living, of which you are a part, which you interact with. And it also asks you to study your own mind, with which you look at this world. And what's the true nature of this world? And what's the true nature of our own life? So it says, what's the nature of this physical universe? What's the nature of our own mind? Its characteristics, the way it functions. And what is the real meaning of life? So yoga says, there are two fundamental categories, Purusha and Prakriti. Prakriti is Jata, but it is the source of the whole process of evolution. The entire universe is constituted by its evolutes. But by its nature, it is unconscious. Purusha is conscious, but Purusha is not involved in this process of evolution. So frequently what happens, you know, we are in our true nature, Purusha, the eternal, the immortal, conscious reality. But we forget that. When we come into contact with the external world, which is nothing but drishyam or prakriti. So then we know what happens when we interact with different things at the mental level, emotional level, physical level. We forget our true nature and we identify ourselves with all these momentary impulsive experiences. So we lose the awareness of our true nature. In Vedanta, we are one eternal, immortal, conscious reality, Atman. In yoga, the word Atman is not used in that sense. The word Purusha is used in the sense in which Atman is used in Vedanta. Of course, in a different sense. Differently. That's all. So remember, this question always, why should there be this world? Why should there be this association? Why should there be all these problems in this world? Those questions are very relevant only if you accept that this God, this world was created by a God, a particular deity. On the other hand, here we are not worried about that. You look at your own mental world, your own inner world, emotional world, and also the external world, and try to find out the cause. So tracing from effect to cause, the way the scientists do, you know. That's what yoga is doing. Yes. So why should the consciousness associate itself with unconscious prakriti? Why should it? Yes. So I tell you, you know, yoga system of philosophy is remarkable only for its psychological analysis of the human impressions, memories, and all that. Which in Ayurveda?
In the Ayurveda, Vedanta, which believes that there is a God and that there is a point of creation, why is it that we have all been now created to separate?
Yes. You know, in Advaita philosophy, the idea of God and creation are accepted. But Advaita says that there is a higher ideal. When you reach a higher level of spiritual evolution, you realize that the God as a divine reality is omnipresent and immanent. So, depending upon our own spiritual evolution, Advaita does not reject monotheistic ideas of creationism, a creator God. It does accept, but it says when you go beyond that level, as you become a great devotee, you can find this idea not only in Vedantic tradition. At least one great Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart, speaks of the supreme Godhead, which is beyond the concept of Trinity, which he says beyond name, is a great being, indescribable, which is immanent, which is transcendental and omnipresent. So you find in all traditions where they go beyond the theological, the philosophical limitations, when they reach the highest level of mystical inner experience, there is always an idea that God is not just a being who sits above after creating this world and watches over you. God sits in your own heart.
I concede to all of these, and I'd even further that all the great spiritual traditions are designed for us to actually return to the truth.
Excellent. Oh yes, why can't we be born with this full knowledge, with this full realization.
What is the rationale behind this great humanity game that we find ourselves
yeah. in? Yes. Yes. Yeah. I understand. Yeah. So Vedanta says there is a fundamental non-awareness in us. Fundamental non-awareness. It's called avidya, mula avidya. It is not sin or any anthropomorphized conception of evil. What did you say? Fundamental non-awareness. In fact, there are many people who are born with this awareness. You come across many great saints who are born with this awareness. See, a man like Shankaracharya, he became a philosopher when he was just 6 years old. There are stories of people who are being born. Swami Vivekananda got this knowledge realization after he went through Scottish Church College and Presidency College. But his guru Sri Ramakrishna, as a 5-year-old boy, he had this realization. So the question is, there are people who are born with this awareness. Of course, at different stages in their life, this awareness manifests. There are people. Oh, you can. How do you explain Jesus Christ who argued with the rabbi when he was 12-year-old boy? He went for the census registration. You know, he was living in an inn. Then he was lost, and his parents went back and found him arguing with the rabbi, with the senior priests. You find many great men and women who are born with this awareness. So if you ask the question, why can't we all born with this awareness? That question takes us to another level. Why should there be a creation?
Yeah, exactly,
right. Exactly. Why should there be a creation? You're right. The question to the answer is given Vedanta. Intellectually, if you approach, there is no answer. But if you take the spiritual path to inquire, there is an answer. The answer doesn't take the form of an explanation in verse, but it becomes an experience. And if you really pursue this path, why should there be a creation? You will come to one answer. The creation itself is only a relative phenomenon. Creation itself is not absolutely real. So one great answer is Logavattu Leela Kaivalyam. It's a Brahma Sutra, comes at the end of the empirical book. Means this world itself is a play. What is play? Play is not totally unreal. The play is a play after all. So like that, when you, not through intellectual discussion, but through spiritual practice, when you reach the highest level, you suddenly realize, oh, all this job security, medical insurance, all the huge wealth that we have in bank. We remember, no, you should listen first. All these things, oh, they come and go. Our health, our wealth, our reputation, everything's fine, but then they won't be there after some years. And they were not there before some years earlier. So what are they? They exist for some time. When children play for half an hour, they're very serious for half an hour. But they are not serious before that, and they are not serious after that. The 49ers, you know, when the play is over, they'll be staying in 5-star hotels. They are not playing anymore. When they're playing, they're real play. Like that, when you reach a higher level of transcendental experience, not argument, experience, when you look back, you smile. You were so serious when there was a traffic jam. And you went mad. But then next day you think, oh, it was really, I was making a fool of myself when I got excited. There was a traffic jam. So that stage of looking back from a higher wisdom, from a higher perspective, that is Advaita. And at that point you'll realize this world is there as much as a play is there. It's a relative entity. So in the sense, this world is not absolutely real. It is only a relative entity. This is the answer in Vedanta. And with that, in fact, and that is supposed to be the most logical answer. Because Vedanta does not tell you the world is totally unreal. It would be totally wrong. This chair is there. But Vedanta says, this chair won't be there after 1,000 years. You can be sure about it. And it was not here 1,000 years earlier. Or maybe before the world was created. The universe came into existence 13 billion years. So the whole point is, Vedanta tells you, this creation, this srishti, is not totally unreal, but is not absolutely real. It is non-eternal. And that is perhaps the answer that comes very close to what modern scientists are telling you. The world is constantly changing. That's the idea behind. So that will solve the problem. Why can't God create this world with everything is wonderful? After all, for God, this world is not so serious. For us, it is serious. God doesn't think this world is such a wonderful thing. Everything should be perfectly all right. So very often, we look at the whole thing from our intellectual point of view. And Vedanta tells you the truth comes to you when you go beyond the intellectual. This is a very interesting theory. First of all, when you reach your moksha, nothing disappears. You know, Vedanta tells you that one can live in this world in a state of complete liberation. Living in the world is not necessarily living in a state of bondage. The word used in Sanskrit is jivan mukta, means jivan api mukta, means you are mukta, you are liberated, you are still living in the world. Otherwise, what's the difference between a Ramana Maharshi or a Buddha and an average person who gets loses his sleep when the stock market collapses? What's the difference? The difference is if a Buddha also becomes an industrialist, financier, he also may lose his money, but he won't lose sleep over that. That's the main difference. A Buddha or a Jesus Christ would not lose sleep if the stock market collapses. If you are not liberated, you will lose your sleep, you may lose your mind. So one can live in this world. The greatest spiritual persons the world has seen. Who are they? The great epoch makers, the great founders of religions, those who taught great things, great spiritual truths to the world. They lived and worked for the world. In fact, in sheer volume, physical, intellectual work, the great prophets, the great spiritual teachers of the world had worked much, much harder than any living ordinary human being, any workaholic professional, the amount of work they have done. But they lived in the world, but they worked with a different perspective, and they looked at the world from a different perspective. So please remember, the world doesn't disappear when you become liberated. But you start looking upon the world from a different perspective. Your perspective changes. You are no more a slave of the world. Sri Ramakrishna puts in a very simple language everyone can understand. He says, it's like traveling in a boat. If you have no interest in spiritual life, then you are like a person who travels in a boat and allows the water to enter the boat, which you know what happens. But if you're a liberated person, then you are like traveling like a person who travels in a boat, but the boat is on the water line. The water doesn't enter the boat. So one can live in this world without the water. I mean, water stands for, correspond to worldliness or world entering the boat. So your whole perspective changes. You become calm and quiet. You become serene. You are no more affected. You may interact with the world. You become totally sensitive. You may look after your family. You may look after your obligations, everything. But you are no more mentally enslaved by the conditions that's around you. That attitude, that perspective, is all the difference that liberation brings in your mind. That's nothing else. Some of the greatest, you know, in the Mahabharata, the great teacher was liberated. He was a butcher. And he was cutting meat and distributing it among the customers when his student came to him. He didn't stop his work, asked him, wait for some time. He was not sitting in a cave. He was doing his duty, but with calmness. And after finishing his duty, he expounds the highest wisdom. You can find several examples. Hundreds of such examples you find in Mahabharata and Vedic literature. But the highest wisdom comes from people who are busy in their everyday life, everyday world responsibilities and duties. But it's not intellectual conviction, but rather is inner experience. That alone brings about a complete, real change. So, thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om. That's it. Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa.